My name is Warren Goldstein. So, just as an introduction, I have a drive, especially when it comes to the holidays, to really understand practically, because that I feel if I don't come out of a yuntif, out of a holiday, where I've been challenged and tried to work on those things to be inspired, then I've missed it. And there are many different ways of inspiration. One is just a deep philosophical presentation that wows me in terms of the depth of the yuntif. And the other is practically, what are the practical questions to challenge myself with, whether it's Pesach, Hanukkah, etc. And I especially feel Hanukkah gets a short shrift because, the Hanukkah parties and the food and this, that at times we can really miss the power of this, especially when you start seeing clearly that it is the reason, Hanukkah and Purim, really the reason you and I are here today. That without it, we never would have survived. Without the principles, the collective, what it did for our collective psyche, etc., we would not be here. And what I'd like to try to do is first take a look at a conflict that the Torah introduces for us, literally from the beginning, that has been a constant up to this very day. To look at that, see how it really, in a certain sense, it's the first time that a foreign power is challenging us with that Hanukkah time, how it's been that way literally every year since Hanukkah, and if we have some time to look at perhaps four practical streams that evolve from this conflict today in 2000. So let's start and see how far we can get. We have to what time? What time is supposed to go to?
Two?
No.
Okay. 2:30. Okay, great. So let's take a look at Migdal Babel. And you'll find this on page 48. Just again, just looking at this straight, simple shot in the psukim. Let's take a look and see what we get from here. So the pasuk starts off by Yehi Kol Haaretz Safa Echas Udvarim Achadim, and the whole land was one language and words of oneness. So in other words, it seems to be telling us two things: that on one hand, there is people are speaking a common language, which obviously I have a problem because take a look in two sentences previously, where there it says, Ela b'nei Shem l'mishpachosam l'lshon nosam b'artzoseyam l'goyeyam. These are the names of Shem according to their families, according to their languages. So what's going on? So you have different ways of understanding it. One way of understanding it is Rabbi Hirsch, who understands that you have different dialects, but they can understand each other. So l'lshon nosam means that different dialects were produced over time, but they were able to understand each other. Another way, perhaps, of looking at it, there was an Esperanto, right? That there was a universal language as well as distinct languages. So they can understand each other, right? So that maybe Hirsch not being too far away from Switzerland. Perhaps that is the reason he comes to that understanding. But be that as it may, they understand each other, but not only is there one language, the sentence tells us with Dvarim Achadim, words of oneness. In other words, that it seems that utopia has been reached. There's no fighting around. Everyone believes in the same things. So therefore, we want to look at this, at the story very carefully, where they go wrong. I mean, you seem to have reached the messianic time period. So let's go on. And it was when they traveled from the east. The pasuk doesn't tell us what the reason for it is, but for some reason there was a urge to travel from the east. And they found the valley in the land of Shinar, which later becomes Babylonia, and they settled there. Not only not only did they, Vayogar is that they only meant it temporarily, but Vayeshu is they meant to settle there permanently. Okay, in a valley. So now, sentence two, Pasuk Bet begets Pasuk Yimel, right? They're in a valley, and what does this beget? We're doing Migdal Babel on page 48. It causes them, Vayomru Ishal Re'ehu, and each one said to his friend, again, that sense of unity, each one is talking to Re'ehu, to his friend, Hava Nilvan Olavenim Nispol Esreifu, let us build, make bricks, and burn, produce bricks, Vativa and Olavenim La'oven, and the bricks will be for stone, Vachema Hoyalahem La'homer, and the mortar will be for clay, for cement. So why does Pasuk Gimel follow Pasuk Beis? Is very clearly, if you take a look at Rashi, where he says, Levenim she'ein avonim b'bavel she'vikam. You don't find stones in Babel. It's a valley. In other words, there's no natural stone. I don't have a natural way of being able to have stone in order to build. So this now encourages and brings a need for humanity to find an artificial means for producing of stone. And they're able to discover. Now, the Torah is telling us of a tremendous technological breakthrough here, where now they can go into places where they're not in mountainous regions, and they have the ability to still be self-sufficient in terms of the ability to build. Tremendous technological advancement. So again, Pasuk Gimel now begets Pasuk Dalet. And what do we have here? Vayomer, and they said, Hava nivna lanu ir, let us build a city, Umigdal, and a tower, Barosha Bashamaya, and its head in the heavens. You ever drive downtown and on a cloudy day and see a tower, its head is in the heavens? I always think of this pasuk whenever I see it, and I think it's also the same strain, the same reason why that's done as they're doing back here. So let's take a look. The Nasalun is shame, and will make for us a name. Do you see the obvious problem here? What is the obvious question? Social status, that's true. Let's take a look at the simple essay, the Nasalun Hashem, will make for us a name. So usually when you make for yourself a name, it's to be famous regarding other people, those outside of you. You're already getting to the answer, but the point is, they're all this, right? They're together here. There's no one else. There's no one else anywhere else. What? That's right. So, remember by Adam, God brings man, the animals, to name. That's the first place you find the concept of a name. So obviously there, what does name mean? It wasn't arbitrary, the name. It was, what is Adam? I want you to understand what is this animal's function. What is its reason for being? And that's what they're saying today. We need an identity. We need a reason for being. We have to find for ourselves that what is our identity, because if we don't, hen naflitz al pnei kol haaretz, lest we will be scattered. In other words, if we don't have a collective identity from which we rally around and unifies us, then we won't be able to stay together as a community. So what is it that they want there? What does the pasuk tell me clearly is the basis for that identity? Take another look at Pasuk Dalet. What is the basis for that identity? It's the physical structure. Right? The city with its tower that its head is in the heavens. 100%. And but what's the defiance? Because what does the tower represent? Our technological powers. That our identity is our abilities. Our power and our self-sufficiency. That's who we are. That's right. You see, this story opens up the constant struggle that man has between an egocentric view of the world or a theocentric view of the world. That's what's going on here. In other words, that man has this drive for independence to be God, as opposed to finding his self-worth, finding his identity, right, through the relationship with God. And that's what the Torah is introducing here, because before Abraham comes onto the scene, It wants to teach us what is the universal conflicts that will always be there with humanity. Is it an egocentric view of the world, or is it a theocentric view of the world? What? Okay. I think the next time it manifests itself amongst the Jewish people is the golden calf, but we don't have time to learn that. But I think Hanukkah, what? It's not the Jewish people, correct? I understand. Well, see, what it's saying is this. The first two parshiyot are there to teach us why is there a need for Abraham to come into the world? Why is there a need for the Jewish people? So it's teaching us why universal humanity opts out of its relationship to God. So that's why when I study the story of Cain and Hevel, I have to understand what is the strain that the Torah is teaching me that is always there in all humanity, not just Cain, right? What is the issue of the flood, right? These are universal issues that not only are they issues in society at large, they're issues between each and every one of us individually that we have to really struggle with. And we all have that struggle. At times we're ready to our relationship with God, we're ready, so to speak, and feel that sense of finding ourselves through it. Other times we want to say, God, please don't bother me. You're bothering me. I want to determine things. Right? What? Fantastic. So, Hanukkah, to me, is really where this issue comes up, where as a Jewish people, it is the first time that we're dealing with a foreign power that dominates us, and two things are happening. One, that the culture is one that is dazzling, that a percentage of us, for the first time in our history, we find it attractive in terms of assimilating into it. It's the Hellenists, right? But also, secondly, it is the first time where a foreign power is saying, I'm interested in stamping out what you believe in. Right? Because what is it? When the wicked, right? So the question is asked, wait a second, is that you want to remove us from mitzvot? So what is l'hashkicham Torah Secha? I think the answer is, l'hashkicham Torah Secha is one thing. It wasn't just, I want them to stop doing these actions. I don't like Shabbos. I don't like circumcision. It's more than that. It's l'hashkicham Torah Secha. It's to cause them to forget their worldview, their philosophy, to cause a complete disconnection between the Jewish people and Torah. That's what's going on. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Let's hold on to that. Let's put that on. Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to intrigue people. Next time you talk to Egel HaZahav. If I am learning through it, it seems to me, you can see it in many different contexts, but Talevi, Malva, and many others, that really what Klai Yisrael is telling God, which is the golden calf, is we will serve you on our terms, not on your terms. You can have a relationship with God ego-centric. That's really where Christianity comes from. It's, okay, you know, it's a time now where, you know, monotheism makes sense, but we still don't want to give up that ability to determine to God how we'll relate to you. So what you come up with is faith over law. Right? It's the acceptance of Jesus that is the basis of your salvation. So now that leaves the rest of life open to me in terms of determining. So let's take a look at this. What is it that so threatens the Greek? Like what is going on there? And I think we'll see that it's the same issue. I don't make any pretensions of being any expert in Greek philosophy, but in having listened to people who have a much greater expertise, it seems to me that this is the basic overview, if you will, that In Greek philosophy, there's a deification of nature. In other words, they looked at each thing in the universe, and they asked the question, what is this thing's function? And what is its natural and appropriate development? And the way the Greeks came to understand the answer is by looking at what does that thing do uniquely? What is its unique function that makes it unique in contradistinction to anything else in the universe? But it was more than that. That not only do I look at what makes a organism, you know, its function, what it's there for, by what it does, it's unique, but there is an actual natural force which drives that thing to become that. So let's say with an acorn, right? What makes an acorn, what is its function? Well, what it does is that's unique, is turn into the oak tree. But the Greeks believe that there's an actual natural force that drives that acorn to turn into that, to turn into that oak tree. The same way that a dog, when it sees, is thirsty and it sees the water, there's this natural force that, you know, desire for it, so too. So therefore, in terms of the human being, what is the human being do uniquely best is mind, right? That's how we came to understand what is the reason for being of anything, including ourselves. So it's very interesting. In the deification of nature, who ends up where, what's man's position? It's again an egocentric position. What? Again, because who in the end run will determine and find those truths and determine what's right and wrong, etc. It's going to be man. And therefore, it's very interesting that when you look at it from that perspective, on one hand, the tremendous philosophy, but also the focus on the human being, right? The perfecting of the human body. In Greek art, the human body is a tremendous point. So on one hand, you have these tremendous things that are brought into the world. You know, Yaf Delokin Liyaf, this beauty of the celebration of, you know, of the mind and the introduction of culture. On the other hand, it's not surprising how brutal Greek society is. Whether it's belief in infanticide, whether it's belief of killing off of the elderly that have stopped becoming functional. You know, the celebration of the warrior. You know, Sunday entertainment wasn't turning on the Toronto Argonauts. Going into the Coliseum and watching people kill themselves. This was entertainment. People have their popcorn or the equivalent and, you know, and are watching that. So the Greek takes this egocentric drive in the human being and develops something that's incredible. And for many Jews, they succumbed to it because it was so intellectual, so dazzling, so... But for most Jews, they saw through it. They saw, again, the famous statement of the rabbis, the pasuk Yavda Lokim Liyefet, the Yishkan Ba'olei Shem. That Greek culture becomes beautiful when it's dwelling in this tense of Shem. Because the culture, where again, man is at the center and man determines, right? We understood deep down, I'll put it in modern terms, that you can have Goethe and Schiller and Wagner and be playing Wagner while you're gassing people. This is what we understood. Now, we saw through the egocentricity. Let me show you something absolutely beautiful. The second parak of the second mission of Perkei Avot is who? Shimon HaTzadik. So Shimon HaTzadik lives in whose times? Alexander the Great. Right? 313, fourth time there, Alexander defeats the Persian. And now Greek culture starts its ascendancy. So in Perkei Avos, when someone is saying something, it means that this is what he felt has to be brought into the generation of the Jewish people at that time. So what does he say? On three things the world stands on: Torah, Avodah, and Midas HaSadeh. Right? So if you think about it, I saw this, I think it's absolutely brilliant, is that what Shimon HaTzadik is trying to counteract is the evils of Greek egocentricity, and that man determines. So what is the first thing he's saying? Well, three things the world stands: Torah, right? So obviously he means Torah as separate from connecting to God, so to speak, and service, right, relationship to God. So one way of understanding it is that what Shimon HaTzadik is saying you can't have a world where right and wrong is determined by man. Because if it is, there's no such thing as right and wrong. It just, it's relative. And if it's relative, it means nothing is right and wrong in the objective sense, and therefore anything goes. And therefore, that's the first thing on the base of which a society can survive, is the concept of that it is God who dictates to us and tells us what the right and wrong is. Tarsha v'kav, but also Tarsha v'kav. But the second point is where do we find our self-fulfillment? And that's avodah. Now what Shimon HaTzadik was saying to that generation, do not get fooled. Do not get fooled that your self-fulfillment will come by proclaiming yourself in the sense, like Greek culture is doing. It's based on avodah. But the third point is Shimon HaTzadik perceives that we've got to bring in and keep within the Jewish people this idea of that I am outside of myself, that life is not based on self-absorption and egocentricity. Where does that come? Through the practice of the Jewish self. Where I say I have a responsibility to the people outside of myself. Right. Right. That the idea of that I find myself through serving something greater than myself and outside of myself. It's precisely these three things that he has to stress when Greek culture starts becoming the dominant force in civilization. I think it's absolutely beautiful. Right. That's right. Again, in the beginning, there's no coercion. So by the time the office comes on the scene, you already have a percentage of the Jewish people that buy into it. More than that, if you read through Josephus, it is those Hellenists that are from the worst of the persecutors. Jason, Menelaus are leading the charge, so to speak, in terms of whether it's turning the temple into a pagan temple, whether it's the killing of Jews who are keeping the Torah. Well, again, I mean, talk about the kind of story today's time. We are dealing with assimilation that we've never dealt with before in history in terms of the collective Jewish people. I'm sure you had the Spanish Inquisition. Before the Spanish Inquisition, you have 50% of the Jewish people that convert to Christianity are aware they accept into society on their own. That's one part of the Jewish people. You've never had this mass assimilation. So yeah, from that perspective, the kind of story coming alive, unfortunately, is very real. Yeah. Celebration of us as warriors. Very interesting. I mean, fierce warriors. 6,000 against 65,000. I mean, fighting prowess. But, you know, the Mei Matachio, if you look carefully, there's a de-emphasis on that aspect. History. Is it natural or metanatural? And Hanukkah was about saying, don't fool ourselves that it was our doing. think there would have been interest.
Because Matitya, when it started, they started with a small group, and nobody wanted to join in. But they said, where did the fun? This is nothing. We will fight. And then they were joined. So I said to them, Kahana, you know, don't be so desperate, because you don't know how many people from Tahab are going to join, because there are people from Tahab in the settlements.
Right.
And now I wonder, when Tahab is going to leave them, how many soldiers from Tahab.
No, what I'm going to do, I'm going to...
I'm going to join the Mitzvah
right.
Kim, who are to be a part
yeah,
of
it. It is important...
It's not my show.
It's
I
an
know.
Important discussion, but let's move back. Let's bring it back.
I don't understand the difference between Torah and Avodah.
Now, what I'm suggesting is this, is that if Avodah means... If Avodah... If what he meant with Torah is like just the learning of Torah, right?
Mm-hmm.
As far as it connecting me to God, that would seem to be part of Avodah, right? So I'm trying to understand, why is Torah separated out from Avodah? So it means I have to find other unique aspects of Torah that wouldn't fit into the category of Avodah. So therefore, what I'm suggesting is that the aspect of that, it is the Almighty that determines what murder is, rights and wrongs, morality, etc., that's what Shimon HaTzadik is expressing here, because the deification of nature really ends up the deification of man, because now man is going to determine the right and wrong.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the rabbis see the personification of Avodah is prayer, because prayer, more than anything else, is where I really come and I talk to God. If there's anything that personifies the idea of my connected outside of myself, Tefillah, because Tefillah is not just a request, it's the relationship. Right, but and Tefillah comes to replace Parban. Right, so you're right. When Shimon HaTzadik is saying Avodah, he's thinking of those terms. But, right, exactly. And are applying it to our times, it would be tefillah in terms of the specific way to manifest that connection. You know, the time where I really feel the pain of it is Hanukkah, but also on Tisha B'Av, right? Because if you read the history, when the Romans are breaking down the walls, you have civil war going on amongst the Jews. While they're breaking the walls, they're shooting at each other. And I'll tell you the truth, if I wouldn't be living and experiencing the last